The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thanks. So good morning. Is the sound okay? Yeah? Okay, great. Yeah, thank you for having me. Nice to be here with you. And I really don't like bringing these things in, especially putting them at the front of the meditation hall. But I had this impulse in the last minute that the talk that I was planning to give was not the right talk. And so that talk has been scrapped, and I actually happen to have my computer, and you thought it was bad too, yeah? So here we are. Anyway, it's such a this gig, this situation is a strange one. It's like what's said has to be obviously the first criterion is like it's got to be relevant for you. Like I'm not here for me, and at the same time, if I'm not connected to what I'm saying, if it doesn't feel alive, if it's like dharma that was maybe real at some point but is not actually like vibrantly alive in this moment, you don't want to hear me talking about that. Yeah. So here we are with a computer. And there's a movie from Hirokazu Kurita called Afterlife, and it's maybe 20 years old. And it's set in a kind of like purgatory-like place, yeah. And the kind of recently deceased arrive in this place, and there are kind of workers, counselors, social work type folks there, and their task is for the recently dead to identify the one moment of their life that they wish to live for the rest of their life. Yeah. And they're tasked with actually identifying what it is and then actually filming the moment. Yeah. And it's a very beautiful evocation of a lot of things. But the notion is that these people are supported in identifying this moment and then in actually constructing the scene and filming the moment, then they vanish into that moment to live it for all eternity. Yeah. There is a wisdom in tending to life and tending to the tasks of living, of arranging the conditions of our life and the conditions of the lives of others in skillful ways. And there's a side of practice that very much calls us into the reflection on mortality and letting go and our relation to that and how that actually can distort our relation to life itself. And so there's a famous, apparently a very, very prominent rabbi, Polish rabbi from the 1800s, and is known for saying something like, everyone should have two pockets, each containing a slip of paper. On one should be written, I am but dust and ashes. And on the other, the world was created for me. And then wisdom is knowing when to reach into which pocket. Yeah. So sometimes it's amazing. The world just feels like so open, you know, like it's like there's a certain kind of grandiosity in it for, you know, in the moment for me. But it's like, especially after coffee. And it's like the universe is the red carpet, and it's just like totally there, yeah. And then there are these kind of other moments where I really just feel like just almost ashamed of the grandiosity of that kind of thinking, and ashamed is not quite the right word, but just like, wow, the depth of absorption in my own little life is just staggering, you know? And here we are at year 13.7 billion, right? And alive for like the belief, you know, the briefest kind of geological blip in time. And we are fragile creatures, right? And we are living in a world with like all powerful laws of nature, right? Like it feels like we control things and we have agency, but we influence things, but control nothing and own nothing. Andrea Fellas said, somebody I know just got back from the long retreat at IMS and was recounting some of her experiences from sitting, and one of the things she said was Andrea was talking about the kind of way that our deep longing to be happy, to be safe, can collide and tangle with the truth of dukkha, anicca, anatta, yeah, with unsatisfactoriness, suffering, impermanence, groundlessness. And it's this kind of collision that we're actually asked to untangle. And it's not like the truth of dukkha, anicca, anatta is necessarily this like tragic problem. And it's not like our own longing to be at peace is a tragic problem. But when they collide in without clarity, without wisdom, this creates a tangle. And so we're asked to untangle the tangle. Now, to look at the tangle, we have to look at an assumption that seems so obvious that it's just unquestioned, which is the assumption that I must go on living. Yeah. The bias for existing rather than not existing, which is like, duh, you know, right? It's like, but it's actually important just as a thought experiment to understand our relationship to life, to death, to mortality. And so the comments that I make are in the spirit of a kind of thought experiment. The philosopher Thomas Metzinger, who writes about ego and self from a kind of philosophical perspective, said, our deepest cognitive bias is existence bias, which means that we will simply do almost anything to prolong our own existence. For us, sustaining one's existence is the default goal in almost every case of uncertainty, simply because it's a biological imperative that's been burned into our nervous systems over the millennia. It's hard to underestimate the theoretical relevance of arriving at a convincing analysis of what 2,500 years ago the Buddha called bhava-tanha, the craving for existence. Now, this is on my mind because I just feel like increasingly sensitive to the precariousness of insisting on living. Yeah. Right. And like I said, that seems like so self-evident. Of course we insist on that. Yeah. And this is not, none of these reflections are actually intended to be to discount the kind of beauty and poignancy of being alive whatsoever. But we want to actually look at what the ways in which our bias towards existing actually can distort our perspective and obscure some of the most beautiful qualities of heart. So we see often, like in the news or something, there's some accident or tragedy, and there's this like scramble to devise new ways of insulating ourselves from that particular threat, and that's important and good. And when we find out a new way that humans can be hurt, a new way that entropy can win and the train can go off the tracks, we should do something to ensure safety, no question. And there's a certain way in which I just feel like kind of a certain hopelessness in insulating ourselves from every kind of threat. And so my mind is increasingly turning to just the pure vulnerability of being human and the impossibility of ever guaranteeing security. And to the extent that my heart and the sense of peace depends on ensuring that security, I am in a precarious position. Yeah. Now, we don't have to in any way let go of our life or anything like that. We just want to actually see how this craving functions. This tumbling forward of becoming. The Buddha said there are three kinds of craving, craving for sense pleasures, craving for non-existence, vibhava-tanha, and craving for existence. And hopefully I'm not aligning myself with a craving for non-becoming, for non-existence, but to just look at the way in which the mind is always tumbling forward, the way in which the self is always projecting itself into the future. So when existence is our priority, yeah, this very innocent bias towards existence, when it's a priority, one of the effects is that our life becomes focused on threat and opportunity. The world becomes a field of threat and opportunity. Yeah. maybe you know those moments when you're just living or taking a walk or something, and there's no sense of like needing to derive anything from the moment. There's no sense, like the heart is just settled and you're not actually trying to squeeze anything. You're not trying to get anywhere or become anything. But most of the time there's a sense of like this moment is a kind of transaction, and this moment in it contains thoughts of like what I will be and how to secure my life and my what matters to me. We start telling big stories when we crave to, you know, this craving for existence. Irving Yalom, a local, said that death anxiety is the mother of all religions. And you can see how just through the history of human thought, that a kind of unbalanced, unclarified relationship to our own mortality has generated, you know, a thousand gods and stories and afterlives and notions of essentially defending against the anxiety we have around our own mortality. There's a whole like body of research that's known as terror management theory, and it's terror not in the sense of terrorism, but the research looks at the ways the mind is impacted when mortality is made salient. Yeah, and so you can do experiments where, if I'm the research subject, I'm primed in some way to reflect on my own finitude. And then you can actually look, okay, what happens to me when that's planted in my awareness? And there are some positive effects. We could spend the whole morning talking about that. But there are also like a cascade of negative effects that are common. Namely, like more prejudice and a kind of in-group favoritism and in authoritarianism. When we actually become aware of our limits, part of what they feel that happens is that we become more deeply attached to our cultural identity and worldview. Because this itself is a kind of, this is our symbolic legacy. So I may not live forever, but these ideas, these identities, these cultural views, I am an American, right? Well, that will go on, yeah? And so this is my afterlife. This way in which the heart's lack of resolution around these themes of mortality distorts the our life, and we tell stories, some of which have profound implications for how we get along with each other. One teacher said the degree to which we're afraid of death is the degree to which we're unenlightened. Yeah. And sometimes, just like through some kind of intuitive hit, maybe you get a sense of how open the world would be if we were less afraid. If that the craving for existence settled even somewhat. it's like, yeah, the world is really transformed when we begin to let go of some of that clinging, because we don't, we no longer sense our life as a kind of labyrinth to get through, and other people as, you know, fitting into that labyrinth. There's just this like radical openness. Early in my my practice, I got the instruction. It was quite meaningful to me. And the sitting instruction was sit like a dying person, and that may mean many different things. But for me, the effect that it had on my heart was, if there were no future, what could possibly be worth clinging to? If I sit here without the sense of tumbling forward, without the sense of imagining myself as a figure in time, sandwiched between the past and the future, what would be worth clinging to? What papancha and distortions, what would actually be worth grasping to? But this craving to become makes us just naturally obsessed with the future, right? So we want to actually look at our mind, to look at the way the kind of future obsession functions. There's a group of researchers talking about prospection, looking forward, and the kind of prominence of that in human cognition. So they write, over the course of each day, people devote considerable time to thinking about the future. People simulate and evaluate possible encounters with friends, colleagues, partners, and even their future selves. They form intentions to communicate, to take prescribed medications, to pick up items at the grocery, to plan routines. Despite the seemingly innumerable ways in which people think about the future, we propose that prospective cognition may be organized into four modes of future thinking. Simulation, like we know that experience of like creating a detailed picture of what may become, yeah? Prediction, what's the likelihood of something happening? Intention, you know, setting particular kinds of goals. And then planning, which is identifying and organizing the steps towards achieving a goal. Yeah. That probably covers a lot of what happens in meditation, right? Like, and it feels like that's our work to do, right? Like it can feel, to actually let go of some of that can feel unsafe. In a subtle way, to actually relinquish the kind of obsessional focus on arranging the future can leave us feeling the kind of, yeah, the vulnerability of being human. Now, this also manifests in this craving to become. It manifests not just as a way of ensuring our existence, but of becoming something, becoming, growing into an identity, you know? That way in which we sort of like, we're looking to come home to Sakaya Ditti. We're looking to come home to find a place of comfort in identity, in being something, in becoming something. And so it's not merely actually trying to just stay alive, but actually to inhabit an identity. And the Buddha sort of implied, like, we can never arrive in an identity. An identity will never actually feel like home, like refuge. We like seek that security, but it's forever deferred. So Ajahn Sumedho asks us to listen to the way that bhava tanha functions in our life and in our practice. Right, so he often talks about, like, the setup for meditation is often like, okay, here I am, Matthew, this human being with problems, and I'm going to do practice in order to become enlightened, right? And okay, here we go. And there's this way in which I become the kind of like project and project manager, you know, right? And the meditation takes on this flavor of we're just like this big self-improvement project, and embedded in that is a sense of becoming. Yeah, the sense of like the practice is tied up with that, the becoming the good Buddhist or whatever it may be. Now, this gets tangled up with our sense of self in other ways. We usually think about the self as the kind of the cause of things, like our agency, our sense of who we are, our intention is very closely tied to our sense of self. And so we think about the self as the cause of things. But the Buddha said, we must look at the self as an effect of things. That the sense of self is actually an effect. And to just be most reductionistic about it, it is the effect of clinging. So we ensure our safety, we ensure like our continued existence by hallucinating a self. Like this is actually, it seems to me like a kind of inherited strategy of navigating threat and ensuring survival. So maybe you know the experience of, it's like when we are sitting and the more settled and safe it feels, the more the self recedes into the background, the thinner the self gets, right? Part of practice is it's making our inner life more and more safe. We become just develop this very loving relationship with our inner life, and develop a kind of confidence in the heart and confidence in equanimity, such that our inner life becomes more and more safe, feels more and more safe to inhabit that realm. And in that process of feeling more safe, and this might just be for a moment as we sit, it's like the busyness of self and I am-ness just fades. And then maybe there's a loud noise or something startles us, and it immediately puts us back into that corner of the mind, the sense of self that all of a sudden feels very prominent, and we organize our life to ensure that things are okay, to ensure existence. So in this way, maybe we say the self is an effect of fear. An effect of fear. And the fear that convenes all fears is the fear of our own mortality. But the self is often also what makes our own mortality so terrifying. Because when we have a health situation or disease, or where there's just an acute sense of threat, part of what happens when we actually reflect on mortality is that we're envisioning the destruction of the self. It's not merely like my body. It's like there's this sense of like that precious I am being extinguished. But we're asked to actually look, like, what are we actually protecting? And in what ways, as we become more and more free of this identification with I am-ness, with self-view, does that actually free us up in a way to live and die more effortlessly? Derek Parfit, another philosopher, was very, very interested in this, and he talked about the self as the deep, further fact beyond all the tangible realities of being a person, that deep further fact of self. And the illusion of that deep further fact for him was tied to a certain kind of fearlessness. So he writes, it's difficult to believe that there is no such thing as an all or nothing self, no deep further fact beyond the multitude of small psychological facts that make you who you are. When I believed that my existence was such a further fact, I seemed imprisoned in myself. My life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year, and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. Now I live in the open air. There is still a difference between my life and the lives of other people, but the difference is less. Other people are closer. I'm less concerned about the rest of my own life and more concerned about the lives of others. So we settle into the stillness of the moment. And there's a certain kind of vigilance of not getting seduced by the machinations of becoming. That pull into the sense of creating a future. And in awareness, there is no past, no future, not even exactly a present. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming, said in the suttas. To actually fully put down that subtle tumbling forward, that subtle layer of restlessness, of agitation, that is trying to arrange our existence and its continuation. So we can ask, what would it be like? What would the moment be? How open, bottomless would the moment be without any notion of a future, of becoming? If this was it, if this moment was it. Not that there's no moments in the future, in the future, no moments coming, but just this actually is it. What does that do to the mind? Just sit for a moment.